The following Dharma talk was given by Bear Gokhan Bonnebaker at Zen Mountain Monastery. Gokhan Osho is a Dharma holder and priest in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. I've been giving some talks over the last couple months on the Eightfold Path. And started these a couple months ago, kind of in preparation for the retreat that we did this weekend, thinking that I would have worked my way through the Eightfold Path by now, and it's taken a little longer than I thought. So the Eightfold Path, right understanding, right view, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. In the retreat yesterday, we were focusing on, in part, on this kind of foundational dynamic of our life, the suffering, dis-ease, dissatisfaction, and how that is caused, how it is created. The teaching, the Eightfold Path, is noble truths, is because it is created, it doesn't have to be created. This foundational dynamic of our life, which will continue, it will continue unless we do something differently, until we do something differently. And so recognizing in our own mind, how is this happening? What are we creating? Studying it in our own experience. The Eightfold Path is the way to do something differently. And this is the original teaching, 2,500 years ago, the Buddha's own words. And Buddhism has evolved over these many centuries. But this is still the foundation. It's still the sort of the pith teaching, the heart of the teaching. The ways that we take up practice here, to look into them, they are the same teaching. They are the same, coming out of the same teaching. And as I've said in some of these other talks, the importance, the appreciation that there is a path, there is something to do, there is a way. And this Eightfold Path that allows us to really take up each part of our life as practice, as a way to study, to enter, as a place to do something differently. And the path factors, steps of the path, they all go together, they work together. The teachings on practices, cultivating wisdom, cultivating understanding of just how things work, seeing our mind. The morality factors, sometimes called the discipline, ethical discipline. And the concentration, the working with our mind, right? Our focus, our foundational practice, zazen. But they all work together. We need all of them. We take them up all at once. This is not the kind of path where it's one step after another, one at a time. And so I want to talk today a little bit about right action and right livelihood. So we're in the morality section. It's kind of this usually the middle section as the path is presented. I would maybe include the second factor as well, right thought. We're working with body, speech, and mind. Understanding of cause and effect, understanding that there is an effect. There is in how we use our mind, how we use our speech, how we use our bodies. And understanding cause and effect, understanding that we all have power. Our thoughts, our speech, our action have an effect. We have power. It matters how we use our body, speech, and mind. It matters how we use this power that we have. How do we want to use this power? And these moral teachings, you know, when I kind of came to this section, I was a little bit like, wasn't sure if I was comfortable talking about morality. And as I started to think about it, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about is how much we need this now. How much we need these, in a way, very simple teachings, but true moral teachings. These simple teachings don't create harm. Do good. Do good for others. We need this. I was talking to someone recently who was kind of coming back to practice or to formal practice after some time. And they said part of what was bringing them back was what's going on in the world. And they said that they felt like they couldn't do anything. Kind of saying that they had no power. And I understand that. It is hard to see what I have been asking the question. I ask the question, what should I be doing? I think we should all be asking that question. And it's hard to tell. But we should not forget that we have power. We each have power. We always have that. And we should use it for good. Right action arises from seeing the intrinsic wholeness and interconnection in the world. From understanding, from realizing, from knowing the wholeness of our life, the interconnectedness of our life. And this is the basis for the precepts, moral and ethical teachings as we take them up in Zen more specifically. And it takes some time to have some actual understanding of this wholeness, experience of this wholeness of our life. But I think we also should, this is like, as with many of the teachings, all of the teachings, a place to hear that teaching. Take that in, kind of know that, have a question, what does that mean? And try to remember that that is the truth of our life. And study for yourself, look for yourself, realize for yourself. And so the precepts are based in this understanding of the wholeness of our life. And they also acknowledge that we will always live in this world of difference, this world of cause and effect, this relational world, world of desire and aversion. We will always encounter difficult people, difficult situations, which really don't feel like wholeness and interconnection. How do we hold both of these truths of our life? And how do we act? We act in accord. The precepts point to places where we get confused. How is it that we get confused? They point to places where there are sort of natural human tendencies, desires, energies. We talked a little bit yesterday about how there are healthy desires. Desires are not bad. Where is the problem is the question, is the place of study. There is a way in which desire can lead us into life, into our own life, into the interconnection. But our natural, healthy, human desires and aversions, fears, can also lead us into confusion. We can get confused. They can lead us further into confusion. How is it that we get confused? We can look at it as like we forget our wholeness. We forget the truth of wholeness. And we kind of do this all the time. There are all these different ways that we hold ourselves separate. Just this morning, seeing people in interview, it's like we all have our own way of holding ourselves separate, holding ourselves outside, outside of our own life. And so, in looking at desire, looking at fear, looking at aversion, it's like there is truth to that teaching, and I think it's sort of like it's like a code word, right? We have to then find what's our way, what's the way that we get caught, that we get confused, that we hold ourselves outside, that we get, because the confusion so often is something is happening here. And so now this is all I'm seeing. This is all I'm worried about. I'm afraid and I'm comfortable. I'm scared. That's all I'm worried about. All I can see. And so I'm just reacting from that. I've forgotten about everything else. Or I'm caught in a desire. There's something I have an urge. I want. And it can feel like we are caught. It feels like that, right? And we can't see anything outside of that in that moment. We have forgotten everything else. And so we talked a little bit, someone was talking about slowing things down, right? Why we practice mindfulness, why we sit zazen so much. It's like, so you can see things that have come and go. Slow things down enough to see things coming and going, seeing what happens, see how we get caught. There is something that happens just in seeing, just in being aware, just in knowing what is happening. And there also, if there is some space, if things are slow, if things slow down enough, we may be able to see that we can do something different. We can make a choice. Maybe that doing something different is just not doing anything. Just stay there. Just stay with what you're feeling and don't do anything. Because maybe I know from experience that when this is happening and I do something, it doesn't go well. I've been thinking about how that's a part of that sort of restraint is an important part of practicing with the precepts, right? A lot of the precepts sort of traditionally are presented as don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, right? And I think that there can be, you know, sometimes morality has been used in a way to hold us back, to suppress, to oppress. And we can do that to ourselves. But so I think important to see in practicing the precepts and in practicing restraint, when that is skillful, that we choose that. That does not come from the outside. And why do we choose that? There is choosing just, I have to take care of this discomfort or desire in me right now. And there can be kind of a broader view. I choose a different, I choose something different. I know that there will be human flourishing if I choose differently. Can we choose human flourishing rather than immediate gratification? There's a way in which the parts of the Buddhist teaching is like to take a longer view. This might feel good now, but in a wider view, it's not helpful. And the precepts are practice precepts. The moral teachings are a practice, acknowledging that we are going to forget. We are going to get confused again and again. We're going to forget again. But we come back. We remember. We start over again. We remind ourselves. We pay attention. There is in the teachings, a healthy, what is translated as guilt, right? A feeling, noticing, being aware when I've forgotten and I say something that I can see that didn't feel good for the person that I said it to. Feel it here too, to notice. And then to try to remember next time to do something different or not say anything. I read a book recently by Barry Magid, who is a Zen teacher and a psychotherapist, and his kind of his teaching and I think his life is very much bringing those two practices together. One of the things that really struck me in reading this book was he talks about uses a psychological term or psychotherapeutic term of a curative fantasy. A curative fantasy. What is the fantasy that we have of what our psychological cure is going to be? So I think that's how he's using it. But he's using it then to talk about, well, what is our fantasy of enlightenment, of what practice is going to give us, lead us to? How is it going to be when we finally get there? I think that's a really helpful thing to look at. Right? Do we think that that's going to be a place? Do we think that's going to be a place? Somewhere other than where we are now? Than where we are? Do we think it's going to be a place where there will no longer be complications? There will no longer be discomfort? There will no longer be strong feelings, uncomfortable feelings? There will no longer be desires. We won't get confused. We won't make mistakes. I think it's a helpful, important question because if we think that's the way it's going to be, I think we're going to get disappointed. And it also probably may affect how we practice. So if we think that where we're going is a place where there are no strong emotions, where there are no desires, then are we practicing now by getting rid of those things? By trying to push them away? Kind of cut off those parts of ourselves? We likely came to practice with some of those habits. Right, it's kind of a natural thing. We want to get away from what's uncomfortable, push it away. We know how to do that, not see it, but not to be deepening that habit in practice. That's not going to go well. That's not actually going to be helpful for us, transformative, changing. And, you know, I feel like I am continuing to feel the sort of disappointment of that. like, yeah, life continues to be complicated. And sometimes it's like there's something that I was like upset about recently, and it's like kind of embarrassing, kind of like humbling. It's like, wow, I'm like, see, I'm like caught in this. Even though I, like, there's a way in which I understand, I see what's happening. And so, it's not that there is some other place to go, but can we not get caught so much? Can we be more at ease here in the midst of all these complications? So, how do we work with difficult things? To know that that is our work, that is practice, is to see how we get caught, to see where we are attached, to see what we are creating. And how can we let go? How can we not get so caught, not be so attached? So one place to look, we talked some yesterday about kind of trying to tease apart and see the difference between pain, discomfort, and suffering. There will always be discomfort in our human life, in our sentient being life. We will have feelings. Is that a problem? Where's the problem? How does it become a problem? What is the part that we are creating in our mind with our reactions, with how we react, with our resistance? And so when there's discomfort, what can we learn by staying with it, by staying with the sensation? It's hard to do. It's hard to do. But again, what happens when we can create some space, when we can just stay and pay attention and look what's happening? Just feel what's happening. Like, be inside of your experience. And let all the sort of flailing around that the mind does, can we let that settle? The sensation, and then what happens with the sensation? What happens with the discomfort? What's there? There is something there. There's an experience. But to look, what's happening? You know, and so there are ways in which our practice, the way that we practice together, is set up so that we can do that. We sit still during Zazen. Kind of simple and kind of revolutionary. Right? So that we're not always, that we're not following our habit of moving away, adjusting so that we find, oh, that feels a little bit better. We're constantly doing that. What happens when we just be still, stay with our experience? The spareness of Zazen is the same. It's like there's the distractions taken away. To see how much we want to make it like more complicated. Because like just that silence, just being direct with your mind, then we meet things. Sometimes that's uncomfortable. But what happens when we stay? There's an opportunity when we stay. And also to be aware in that it's to learn that we can tolerate discomfort. We don't have to move away, but not to tolerate suffering. Kind of to the contrary. Shanti Deva says that the Shugen Roshi quotes this often, you know, that like the worst form of laziness basically is just tolerating samsara, which is just tolerating suffering. And so that's, I think, an important, like, kind of subtlety to pay attention to in ourselves, because we're like so adaptable, we can just like learn to tolerate suffering, right? Just decide that's how it is, right? Or kind of misunderstand the teaching and use that to just stay in what's not necessary. Related, I think, is what does it mean? So we talk about like practicing something or sitting with something. What does it mean to sit with something? Maybe something that is difficult, something that is old, something that causes you suffering, that maybe you know causes you suffering. Maybe there's conflict. The instruction of Zazen is to not push away, not cut off, not ignore, not deny, not repress anything. Anything. And don't make more of, don't perpetuate, don't proliferate anything. Anything. Neither of these is helpful. Neither of these lead to transformation, to change, to release. Neither is acting in accord with the nature of things, of what is arising, what we experience, what we meet. We have to find our own way with this. It's not an idea. I think really important to allow it to be kind of a place of inquiry in your practice. How do you meet what arises? Are you letting go? Are you letting things move? Or are you solidifying them? I've been seeing in this, this proliferating, which is kind of a technical term. It's the Sanskrit, I think, is prapanka. I don't know how to pronounce that. Proliferating, to see how we proliferate. And I see that in myself. I understand that as both just saying the same thing to myself over and over again. And there's also often, maybe not always, how it's like saying, and it's not just saying the same thing over and over again, but it's like proliferating. It's leading to something else. It is building. It is one thought to another. And so, just recently, feeling upset, seeing, it was like, then seeing proliferation, seeing how I am proliferating, and seeing what that's doing. I'm like solidifying, no, I'm right. It's making me more upset, or like perpetuating the upset. And sometimes being able to see that and see, oh, and I can stop. I can drop that. I can let go. And that's not cutting off. I can do that in a way that it's just, okay, I can drop that. I can stop. I can choose to put it down. And always to be looking. What's happening? What's happening? What is that? What am I doing? What is there? What am I defending? Teaching the right action includes, I would say this, the pure precepts. Don't do harm. Do good. Do good for others. It includes the precepts on not killing, not stealing, not misusing sexuality. And so traditionally, the precepts are presented as these don't do this, don't do that. Dada Roshi, in the way that he taught the precepts and the way that we teach and practice the precepts here. He added an affirmative to each of the precepts. And so to affirm life, do not kill. Be giving, do not steal. Honor the body, do not misuse sexuality. Shugen Roshi sometimes says, honor the whole person, do not misuse sexuality. And so again, how do we get confused? How do we get confused? You know, and with these precepts, it might seem like, you know, like not killing is like, where is that in my life? Right? It might seem kind of distant. But the precepts are pointing us to look. How do we get confused? Where do we get confused? And so with these precepts, where it may seem like, you know, sort of the gross level, what they're pointing to isn't really a struggle for me, for you probably. But so to look at the affirmative statement, what is it to affirm life or to not affirm life? To look at sort of smaller situations. There's a spider in the shower. It's easier just to like run the water and let it go down the drain than to get it out, take it outside. I can't really remember actually like stealing something. I did once. I'll have a little story, but. But, you know, sometimes it's like living here in community. Am I taking more than my share? Last Hosan, there were some really nice cookies that someone had made and left out. And it's like, I could have taken a lot more of those. But I didn't. Sometimes I do. I call myself, that's my greedy bastard side coming out. Sometimes for me, it's like, can I charge this to the monastery, or does this come out of my stipend? We talked a little bit yesterday about how we can confuse pleasure with happiness. There's natural, healthy joy of connection, love, being loved. We can get confused with desire. With pleasure. How do we get confused? There's nothing wrong with the pleasure, with the desire. But what happens when we get sort of narrowed in and it's just here and we forget? We forget the wholeness, we forget the interconnection, we forget someone else. And there's the teaching on right livelihood. Taking up this human activity of work. We all spend a lot of our lives working in some way. Taking care of things. Earning a living. Whatever it is that we do that. Work brings us into contact with the world in a lot of different ways. And so there's wisdom to the Buddha, including this, is one of the, there are only 8 factors of the path. This is one of them. And I've also always kind of wondered about this factor, because in the teachings on right livelihood, the Buddha doesn't have a lot to say. The teachings are mostly like, don't sell poison and intoxicants and people and weapons. It's like kind of setting a low bar. Seems like. It's including the precepts of not killing, not stealing, not misusing sexuality. You know, the Buddha and his monastic disciples were renunciants. They were not allowed to work. They were not allowed to own anything except some very basic necessities. and were not allowed to accumulate. And so they were completely dependent on others, on the lay sangha. And there was a lay sangha, and the Buddha had lay students. And there's records of that in the sutras. There are teachings that he gave to his lay students. There are teachings that he gave to them about work and about wealth. In a way, what I've seen are simple, be generous, enjoy what you have, but sort of in moderation, take care of others, those that you sort of are in your life that you can take care of. But this is one of the ways that Buddhism evolved. When Buddhism went to China, there was no tradition of almsgiving in China, or not to the extent that there was in India. And so people in China who wanted to be Buddhist monastics, they had to figure out something different. They had to be mostly self-sufficient. They set up monasteries that were not close to cities where they could beg. In many cases, they were more or less self-sufficient. And so right from the beginning in Zen, work has been part of practice. Work has been practice. I think because those early monastics, they must have realized, well, we're spending all of our time doing this, working. It better be part of our path. It better be practice. As we say in our work service, it is no other than the path of awakening. Kind of it better be if we're going to spend so many hours of our life working. And work is another place where we can get confused, where we can get caught up, where we can kind of lose sight. This is a place where wealth and status, money, are so like part of things. A lot of us have learned things about work, attitudes about work, that it's like just to be gotten through, that it's just a way to make money. What would a sort of more modern statement of right livelihood be? We should do work that is healthy for ourselves and healthy for others. Is that available? Is that possible? There is the caretaking, the work, the way that we take up work practice here. That I think is just the Zen practice of work. Let it be simple. Let it be direct. Give it all of your awareness. Learning to come close. Learning to be inside of what we're doing. Inside of our activity. Not so easy to do. But what do we do? What do we learn as we do come closer? Experiencing being more inside, not separate, not holding ourselves apart. What do we learn as we practiced taking care of things, of people? And this simple practice is a practice that you can bring anywhere. It's not easy, but you can bring it everywhere. Anywhere, to any activity. And what is doing our work in a way that's good for us and good for others? Can we practice do no harm, do good for others in our work? Can we let that be more important than praise and gain? And again, to be looking, where is it that we get confused? Where do we get lost? In work. Right, it's interesting that right livelihood in the Eightfold Path, it's one of the morality factors. What is that pointing to? How is it in work that, where is it that we forget cause and effect? We forget the power of our actions, our speech, what we're doing. I That's all I have to say about that. I wanted to thank everyone who was here for this weekend, for this retreat. Sangha is truly a treasure. Practicing together, this happens together. Like appreciating that. It happens together. Dada Rishi used to talk about the mutual polishing that happens from practicing together. So thank you for being here. Thank you for your sincerity, for your practice, for your caring.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.